Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Today is a very, very interesting day in this weekend, this Shabbat. Very, very interesting. We have the confluence, the coming together this weekend of Hanukkah and Christmas and the end of Shabbat. So let me give you tell what's been happening here. This is the first time this has happened since 1796 that we've had these three things. And it won't happen again until 2388. Isn't that interesting? I think that's so interesting, you know? So the confluence of these days, and of course the fact that Hanukkah, we'll talk a little bit about, and of course the celebration of Messiah's birth, commonly understood as Christmas, Yom Yeshua, some people call it, but Christmas. These things, both holidays, of course, have tremendous relevance for us as a Messianic Jewish synagogue. So a few things about Hanukkah, including some of the backstory that you may not know about Hanukkah. First of all, the name Hanukkah, where does it come from? Well, there's various interpretations, but one that I wanted to mention, particularly because we have an adult Hebrew class that's getting really good around here. I'm so proud of them. So Hanukkah, if we think of the words, Chanu is the second person, masculine plural from the verb, which means to rest, and kaf, hey, if you think of the numerical value of kaf, hey, kaf is 20, and hey is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, alphabet, gimel, dalet, hey, right? That's how numbers work in Hebrew. So they rested on the 25th of Kislev. That is, Judah Maccabee's soldiers stopped fighting at the time of the dedication of the temple on Kislev 25. So that's rather clever, and that is just one way to think about the word Hanukkah. But I want to tell you some of the backstory. You know the basic story, the story of how the Maccabees rose up against the Seleucids, the Greeks, and threw their army out, the army of Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, and of course the rededication of the temple. But there is something of a backstory which has some relevance for us today, I believe. Actually, the way this revolt and this problem took place, this war, didn't start with Antiochus. As a matter of fact, it started among our people, among our Jewish people. And it started because the traditionalists didn't like people who wanted to become high priest. They had Greek names. They were in favor of Greek customs. What's wrong with having a gymnasium? What's wrong with working out in the gym? And then you had people on the other side of the coin who favored people who were more traditional. And the fighting became very intense. And only then did Antiochus capitalize on this disequilibrium in Israel, and only then did he side with the people called the Hellenists, or the people who favored the Jews who favored more of Greek ways, and he came in. I just can imagine the Facebook entries. I can't believe those people who would vote for this miserable Hellenist. And then the other side, I can't believe that anyone would vote for these reactionary traditionalists, right? And the net result was this, you know, this antagonism, which resulted in tremendous pain for Israel when Antiochus finally came in. And when he acted contrary to the normal way that the Seleucids would deal with people they took over. Normally, they would, if you want your own religion, have your religion, we won't bug you. But the antagonism between Jews against Jews in Israel over this Hellenization issue, that, it suggested, was what precipitated his, Antiochus, outlawing Jewish things, studying the Torah, etc., etc., and then we get to the mainstream story. I think implicit in this is a bit of an exhortation for us. Be careful with what you say on Facebook. You could start a war. You know what I'm saying? I'm really very serious about that. There are people who've left the congregation because what they see is where they, political views, they disagree with, they go, and then they generalize that to the whole group. They say, well, the whole group must be this. And then you have people on the other side doing the same thing. Would you please, all of us, be careful, recognize no man is an island, no woman is an island. Be very, very careful. Your self-expression is not more important than the unity of the community of Jews who believe in Yeshua. Can you say amen to that today? It's really true. Be very careful, because I've seen the negative results. So anyhow, that's kind of an aside about Hanukkah. Of course, the main thing about Hanukkah is the fact that you had the few against the many, and by that point, the Greeks really did want to wipe out Judaism. It was a bad scene, and Judah Maccabee and his brothers were able to defeat them. The temple was dedicated. Thank God that happened. But again, it was precipitated with an in-house problem that had there not been, the whole thing would have been unnecessary, all of that kind of stuff. Now, however, I want to move from Hanukkah. I'd like to spend the majority of the time that I have with you this morning talking about Yeshua's birth. Because in the world, now is the time, and tomorrow, this evening, is the beginning of Christmas. And Christmas, when we hear that word, some of us, I'm not so sure about that, because we tend to think of it strictly in non-Jewish terms. And added to that, the have you noticed the commercialization of Christmas? Oh, it's so sad. It's so unfortunate, the secularization of these things. Parentheses time, I don't like the expression happy holidays. It neuters Hanukkah and Christmas. It makes it meaningless. What is happy holidays is? It's like talking about God, our heavenly parent. I don't know what a parent is. I know what a father is. I know what a mother is. I don't know what a parent is. But what I'm saying is I don't like that expression, because it tends to dehistoricize and also kind of neuters the holiday and makes it something that has no real meaning and resonance that changes lives and inspires us to great things. End of parentheses. But now I want to talk about this wonderful experience. I'm going to be just commenting for a little while on the good news, the Besorah. Besorah is the Hebrew word for good news, of Luke. And I'm crazy about Luke. Do you love the Gospel of Luke? It's so fantastic. Oh my gosh. They're all great. But Luke, has a special resonance for me personally. So it says this: in the days of Caesar Augustus, who is the ruler of the Roman Empire, Caesar, in those days Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. And this was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Why would Caesar want to take a census? Because he wants to know the relative number of people in different areas, because he wants to know how to tax them and what kind of money he could expect for his empire. He has a census. And this was at a particular time when a certain fellow, Quirinius, was the Roman representative of Syria. What's important about that? Well, in an eternal sense, nothing. But I tell you what I love about it, and I want you to love about it. It places what we're going to be reading about in history. Now, that's a big deal. Because when we start talking about the birth of the Messiah, and we talk about these lofty things that are so far beyond the experience of any of us, the kind of things we're going to be reading, it's easy to throw it into the stratosphere, into the ether of, well, this is just kind of religious mythology and who knows and blah, 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 and it makes you feel good, but who knows if there's any truth to it. Luke does not give us that option. He says, I want to tell you when this happened. It happened during the reign of Quirinius. And you know when that was? Because this happened in real space, real time, because the stuff we're talking about is real. I'm very big on real. I hope you're big on real too. You know what I mean by real? You get what I'm saying about that? It's very, very important. So he places it in the context of real history. And then whether you believe it or not, well, I believe it. I believe it for lots of reasons. But at least know that these gospel writers were concerned about what was real, not just what made you feel good or bad. Very, very important point. And if you want to take a step toward your own maturity as a follower of Yeshua, get this point. It's a very, very important step in the direction of real maturity. Okay, and everyone went to their own town to register. So in Israel, you had to go back to where you were born, and they'd have a desk set up, and they'd go, name, please, and you'd say, and a social security number, and, all that kind of stuff. They didn't have social security numbers back then, but I'm just mentioning that. So Yosef, I'm going to call Joseph Yosef, because that's the Hebrew. And we think right now in the Torah readings, we're in the story of Yosef, and this is his namesake, Yosef. Yosef went up from the town of Nazareth in the Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the household line of David. Now, which David is this? Tell me. King David, right? Why is this important? Because the whole picture of what occurs in this magnificent section from which we get Christmas, if you will, all of this happens in Jewish space, Jewish time. It happens according to the rhythms, personalities, perspectives, orientation, call it whatever you will. All of this happens because this is Jewish stuff that had to happen. And so it's mentioned that Yosef is from the line of David because the Messiah, though he wasn't, as you'll see, the actual physical father, nonetheless, he is in the line of Joseph, because in the line of David. It had to go that way. He had to be in the line of David. He's from David on his mother's side too, but here it's mentioned specifically in Luke that he is of David's line. Now he went there to register with Miriam, who was pledged to be married to him and who was expecting a child. Now this is a very dramatic thing, that here she is, they had not come together as husband and wife, and yet she's pregnant, which left him and the people in the little town there with two choices. Either Miriam, who was betrothed and therefore effectively married in the ancient culture, she really made a big mistake, or perhaps she was raped, but in another case, this is someone else's baby, or something really supernatural is going on here. And we know from another section of this same book, which we won't get into, that something really supernatural is happening. And that is God supernaturally allowed her to become pregnant because the Messiah had to be not just a regular human being. He had to be a fully human being, but there had to be something about him which was transcendent, beyond. He was in some sense reflective of God's very being, and it had to be this way. And so here in this actual historical context, we have Miriam, who is allowed to become pregnant supernaturally. And we could talk a lot. We don't have time to talk about the guts, the courage that she had to have to be able to continue with the program, given the social stigma that she would have been prone to. And it really speaks to her courage. When she says, the angel says to her, here's what's going to happen, Miriam. She goes, well, may it be as you have said. I'm the handmaiden of the Lord. What he's got for me, I'll do. Isn't that a fabulous attitude? Love her attitude. This is one courageous 14 or 15-year-old, I'm guessing, we don't know her exact age, but you know, a younger woman. People married younger in those days than they do nowadays. So I would imagine her as a late teenager, and here she submits, and she is pregnant. And Yosef was intending to end the relationship quietly. He loved her to pieces. He loved her. And he didn't want her to be subject to approbation, to be subject to the wrath of the community because she broke her vow as, you know, a nice Jewish girl. And so he was going to put her away quietly. But then he had a very convincing revelation from God. No, Yosef, don't do that. Miriam's baby it's not what you might have thought. This is supernatural. This thing is from God. So he continues with the plans to marry her. So they go to Bethlehem. And while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. And she wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger, because, it says, there was no guest room available to them. So here you have this amazing paradox. There's lots of paradoxes here, but here's this amazing one. Here you have God, the God of the universe, the God of Israel, and it's a very Israel-centric passage here, the God of Israel allowing this specially chosen, terrific young woman to bear the Mashiach. She's incredibly exalted. The whole experience is amazingly exalting. And here this baby is going to grow up to be the Messiah, and yet he's born. There's not even a hotel room for him. They have to have the baby in the most uncomfortable of circumstances, in a manger, you know. Some people have suggested a cave, but whatever, a manger. And and with the animals around. And so you have this expression of phenomenal humility juxtaposed against the glory and the grandeur of all that's occurring. And that glory and grandeur becomes clear as we move along. And so there they are. She has the baby. And there were shepherds living out in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. So Bethlehem has flocks, and the flocks, interestingly enough, were used for the temple sacrifices, because Bethlehem is relatively close to Jerusalem, and so there are flocks, which suggests that maybe this wasn't in December. So as it's historical, it's rooted in history, and yet we make an assumption that all of this happened in December. But one piece of evidence that it may have been, that the birth of Messiah may have been at a different moment in history, is the fact that there were flocks and shepherds, and not likely in December that they would have been out there. It's not an airtight argument, but it's a probabilistic argument. So in any case, there were shepherds in the fields nearby, and they were keeping watch over their flock, and an angel, a messenger of the Lord, appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them. Now get this in your mind. This is a great scene. And they were terrified. So what is the glory? Well, the glory, that word in Hebrew is kavod. It means heaviness, weightiness, the weightiness of God. In Greek, the word doxa means shiny, shining. You could both put both together. It's a kind of vision. God tears back the curtain that separates earth from his abode, and they see this glory, this shining, this weightiness characterized by shining, brilliant light. And it goes on to say, they were terrified, but the angel said to them, "Don't be afraid. I bring you good news. This will cause great joy for all the people of Israel. Today in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He's the Mashiach, the Lord. And this will be the sign to you. You will find the baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." And suddenly, and here's the glory, even manifested more profoundly, suddenly a great company of heavenly hosts appeared with the angel, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest in heaven, and on earth peace on those whom his favor rests." And so again, the curtain torn back, and here's thousands of angels and maybe people say, who knows, heavenly beings. And they're all just at this moment of history, which is so pregnant in the literal sense, but figuratively pregnant, filled with meaning, as in this point of history that God brings the Messiah into the world through the birth of this little baby. And they're just thrilled, and heaven's clapping and rejoicing and singing, and the angels are, hum, 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 whoa, like that. They're just amazed by what they're seeing. And of course, the angel says to them, the messenger that's relating to them, the angel says, "Don't be afraid. This is great stuff. This is phenomenal. Look what God is doing." The angel left them and went back to heaven, and the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem to see the thing that's happened, which the Lord has told us about." And so they hurried off and found Miriam and Yosef and the baby that was lying in the manger. And when they had seen him, they spread the word concerning him that had been told them about this child. And all who heard it was amazed at what the shepherds had told them. And you would expect people to be amazed. I would guess, as in most of these kind of situations in the Bible, some people said, "You guys have been drinking and we don't believe you." And others said, "No, they seem to be telling the truth. We know these guys, they're not liars. They really saw this thing." And they returned, they were glorifying God and praising him. And then, on the eighth day, we conclude with this, on the eighth day, when it was time to circumcise the child, he was named Yeshua, the name the angel had given him before he was conceived. And so everything comes back to the purpose, the reason. He is Yeshua, from the verb yasha, which means to save. He is going to be the one to save Israel. Now, what is this all about? Hanukkah and the celebration of the Messiah's birth. Well, these things are real. We take them as being true. But the truth, the facticity of it only is of penultimate importance. The real importance is what God is trying to say to us through it all. Now, Dave, when he was talking about the Torah passage today and this uncomfortable passage about a great patriarch, if you will, acting badly. And Dave pointed out that in that kind of society, there was often no justice for women. And we understand that. But I want to tell you, today, there's a lot of people yearning for justice in this world, and they wonder where it's going to come from. Isn't that true? All over. All over. The world has its issues, and I don't want to bring it down, but you know, the things that we think about during the week and struggle with. And the cash value of all this, if I can put it in those terms, is that God really cares about planet Earth. He really cares about his Jewish people, and by extension to all the boys and girls in the world. And the meaning of this day is that the truly great, real ruler gets born into this world. The one who one day, when he comes back, is going to see to it that there's justice for everybody. The one who inspires us with the words that Lawrence read to us today, when Yeshua said, you know, blessed are the poor of spirit. Blessed are the peacemakers. That same one. This one who changed history forever and one day is going to really change things. He's born into the world on this day. And he's done it as this vulnerable child. The ruler of the world, born as a vulnerable little child. And that what that suggests to us is just how fantastic God is, that he is willing to condescend to enter into our experience so completely that he would even allow a piece of himself, if you will, to experience birth and growing up and then the other things we read about in the Gospels, that this whole picture is so fantastic, so wonderful, so great, that when the angels say, be happy and have lots of joy, we can take that to ourselves too. And so I want to include, in conclusion, just encourage you all, whatever you're going through, we're all going through stuff. Everybody is. You can choose to wallow, be sad. You can choose to endlessly be preoccupied with your problems. Or you can choose an expansive life where you choose joy and say, God is so fantastic that I'm going to allow that great truth to eclipse, to dominate my thinking and my actions during the week so that I'm not glum and I'm not miserable and I'm not preoccupied and I'm not just bummed out because of this bad thing or that bad thing, but rather to choose joy because this is a season of great, great joy. So, happy Hanukkah. A joyful and meaningful Christmas, and Shabbat Shalom.